Episode 137 of Futures Radio Show, sponsored by CME Group, the world's leading and most diverse futures and options exchange. CME Group's markets help individuals and businesses around the world manage risk and seize opportunities. Learn more at futuresfundamentals.com.
Every day, traders and investors dive in to tackle the ever-changing markets to find opportunity. Futures Radio Show is your number one source for answers to the questions that all market participants want to ask. Veteran futures trader Anthony Crudele sits down with the most influential leaders and top traders in the industry. Now, here's your host, Anthony Crudele.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the newest episode of Futures Radio Show, where we will highlight our favorite moments of the show over the past month. But before we get started, I want to thank all of our sponsors, CME Group, Trading Technologies, and Top Step Trader. So without further ado, let's dial into those top moments of the show this month. Okay, so you say that time horizon and the broadness of the way you look at things is your edge. I'm very curious, how did you learn this and then realize this was your edge?
It's because when I was running the hedge fund, and even prior to that when I was at Goldman, I realized that I was very good at seeing things, i.e. be able to map out kind of the probabilities of the future and say, well, if that happens, then this happens. And if that happens, then that happens, which is what global macro investing is all about. It's kind of living in the future. But I realized I was particularly good at that. But living over the next 2 months, I found that was noise compared to the actual trend. Because if you think about economies, we get basically one data point a month. So if you think of it in chart terms, it actually means that we get very little data. So you need to look at extended data sets to be able to draw conclusions. So if you think the economy is weakening, then it'll set up a number of trades like buying bonds. Now, the ups and downs of the business cycle in the interim are meaningless, or the ups and downs of overpositioning and underpositioning in bond markets are meaningless, but you kind of know the probability of bond yields falling over the course of the next 18 months, if you think the cycle's weakening, is extremely high. So extending your time horizon, lowering the amount of risk that you take, but extending the time horizon allows you to stay in large economic trends where I think the real money's to be made.
Interesting. So one follow-up question to that is, when you say time horizon, does price get you out? So let's just say that you have a long-term time horizon on something that you think will happen. So when you're thinking that way, when you say 6 months or longer to be in something, now that trade can obviously get there a lot quicker because price would get you out, correct?
Yes. I tend to be more interested in price for putting a trade on than taking a trade off. I tend to be more interested in my thesis being wrong when I take a trade off. So I'm not I found I've probably lost more money in stop losses than I have in anything else. So I tend to try and avoid that. Now, sometimes it will cost me, but generally over time, many themes will play out. So I'm more time driven than I'm stop driven, but on entry point, I'll be very price driven. You know, I use my technicals very heavily for that, and then tend to run trend. Because patterns can, you know, develop, they can overlap, they can do things you're not expecting, and you stop yourself out even though you were right. And I found that happens a tremendous amount of time. Stop losses for short-term trading, much more important, very different game.
I mean, I think as traders, we always have to have open minds. I read a lot of bearish pieces and bullish pieces on a handful of different markets I follow, but I read them to keep an open mind. I'm never fixed on any one idea, and to think that something may or may not happen just because somebody writes it or in a blog post or reports it in the media. As traders, we have to gather the information and, like I said before, read it with an open mind and go in and make our own decisions off of it. I mean, that's the beauty of a market, is that people are going to have different ideas of what may or may not happen, and it's up to you to dissect all the information in front of you and make the best decision. Now, I want to talk about one of your recent posts where you were talking about some opinions that Dalio, Tudor Jones had on risk parity. You also mentioned Axe from Billions, my favorite TV show right now. You said that he would hate risk parity. But talk to us about what Dalio and Tudor Jones were saying, and you had some thoughts on this as well about risk parity. And of course, explain to us why Axe from Billions would hate it.
Okay. So in it basically came about when Paul Tudor Jones got up in front of some, made a presentation, and he said that risk parity would be the hammer that drives the nail, in the next crisis. And basically what he was concerned about was the fact that he believes that their strategy is going to be similar to portfolio insurance in the 87 crash, that they're, because the size of their of their asset allocation is based upon the volatility of the asset, they end up buying more of something at risk. This is risk parity. They end up buying more of something as it becomes less volatile and selling more as it becomes more volatile. That is actually, a negative gamma position. So they're going to be buying high and selling low and making declines or increases all the worse. And although I kind of understand his point of view, I actually look at it a little differently. So I think that if you go back to risk parity, when Ray Dalio came up with it, one of his geniuses was the genius ideas that he had was that he realized that bonds move a lot less than stocks. So when you have a bond that market that, returns 5% or something, it's not really fair because it doesn't have the same drawdowns that a stock would have. So if you volatility adjusted it, meaning that if you made bonds be just as volatile as stocks, you would then therefore find that the bond would return a lot more because you would leverage it up. So what he did was he also he created a portfolio where he had different asset classes, and he basically adjusted them based upon the volatility of the actual asset. So in essence, what this means is that he creates a portfolio that has way, way more bonds in it because they're traditionally or generally the less volatile one. So over the last kind of 30 years, he's had this portfolio that's been overweight bonds. And the other great thing about the bonds is that they're negative correlated with your equities. So when you have a big sell-off in the stock market, your bonds do terrific. So what I worry about is that although I agree with Tudor Jones that the strategy of being negative gamma could cause dislocations in the market, I'm more worried about the bonds portion of the risk parity strategy, because I view that as the portion that is all levered up. That's where the true leverage is. And so I think that if we ever do get a true bond bear market, we could find the risk parity guys hammering on the bond portion of their portfolio way more. And then when you combine that with the fact that everybody else is already overweight bonds because of the 2008 crash and those kind of ideas in their mind, it seems to me that if you were looking for an accident to happen, it's more likely going to happen in the bond market than the stock market. And then in terms of Axe, we know Axe, he's the last thing from an indexer and the last thing from somebody who would follow some sort of system. So we know he would absolutely hate risk parity.
Hey everyone, I hope you're enjoying the show so far, but I want to pause and thank one of our sponsors, Trading Technologies. I started using TT in the year 2000, and I love it. It is by far the best trading platform I have ever used, and I've tried a lot of them. With TT, you can trade the global markets from virtually anywhere in the world. They are the world's fastest commercially available futures trading platform. I highly suggest you go try out TT, especially because you can try it for free. Just go to tryttnow.com and set up your account. I love how you said it's the moment that you realize it was managing risk. It's funny for me, the first couple of years I started in this business, it was nothing but pain. I lost money, struggled. All I tried to do was make money. When I started to learn that this business was about managing risk, I felt so much more focused, so much more at ease. The pressure was off, and I just felt so much more in tune with what I was doing.
Oh, it's so true. Look, the old saw is if you take care of the losses, the gains take care of themselves. And, George Soros has the great line, I'm only rich because I admit my mistakes faster than everybody else. Peter Lynch talks about, human condition is people want to pull their flowers. So they want to take their gains quickly because they're afraid they're going to lose them. And they water their weeds. and they're afraid to admit they were wrong, and they just let a bad position go against them. So there's all of these things, and investing and trading, it is first and foremost managing risk. Do Yep. not allow a bad position to go against you. Do not allow capital impairment. Do not allow permanent capital impairment. That's the worst thing, right? A temporary loss, no big deal. But when you buy something and it becomes truly impaired, you know, whether it's for fraud or from, you know, bad management or whatever it is, you just can't recover when your capital goes away. You can, you know, if you minimize your individual trading losses, you can recover, because you're not going to be right all the time. That's one of the things, you know, you and I on Twitter, we get bombarded with these people. Oh, yesterday you said you loved, you know, Tesla. Now you say you hate it. Well, yeah, because the facts changed. So I changed my mind, and I could love something and be totally wrong, but then I changed my mind and, you know, stop being long and actually go short. That's the nature of great investors. Say good investors sell or cover, right? They sell something they're long, or they cover something they're short. Great investors go short or go long, reverse the position. That's the difference between really good investing and great investing.
Yeah, I completely agree with you on that. That's why it's not always the smartest person who becomes the greatest trader. It's somebody who really can forget about losses. I mean, for me, it's always been about healing. You know, you have a loss, you move on. Be willing to move on. Be willing to be wrong. And have the flexibility to, you and I had a different conversation, or we had a conversation aside from today, when we were talking about how I could read a bearish piece and a bullish piece, and I just want to take my opinion out of it. I want to watch both of them or read both of them, and then I go in and I make my own judgments. And I'm very flexible. I don't care if I'm long or short any one particular market. I just want to be on the right side of it. Okay, we only have a couple minutes left, so I want to talk to you about Brexit. There's talk here of a hard Brexit or a soft Brexit. Talk to us about the implications of either one of those, and maybe how that would lean towards one of those scenarios you previously discussed.
Sure. So let's start with a hard Brexit. Here we're talking about worst case scenario, where potentially not only is it the case that agreement is reached on the terms of a deal, but actually there is no deal. People walk away from the table. So there's the Brexit process is subject to something called Article 50. What Article 50 does is it gives you a 2-year time frame to negotiate the terms of exit. The risk is no deal is reached. In that circumstance, you've got people being cut off from markets because the UK clearinghouses would not have the regulatory recognition that they need that would enable Europeans to continue to meet their regulatory obligations by clearing derivatives, not just euro-denominated derivatives, but any derivatives subject to mandatory clearing on UK market infrastructure. So Europeans won't be able to use that infrastructure going forwards. There'll be open questions about what's the treatment of the derivatives they're already clearing in London clearinghouses, because as a result of losing that regulatory treatment, the regulatory capital rules that apply for derivatives in the London-based clearinghouses also mean the capital that people have to hold against those positions could go up by 25 to 50 times. And if they can't trade out of the positions, they've potentially got capital and positions that are trapped at London clearinghouses. You've also got banks who are providing clearing services looking at worst case scenarios like this. So they're thinking, how can we make sure we can continue to service our clients without disruption? And that is why you're hearing about the banks looking at relocating some of their staff to continental Europe. That might be Dublin, it might be Amsterdam, Paris, or Frankfurt, or elsewhere. And they just need to make sure that in the event of a hard Brexit, where they're not able to service their continental European clients from their office in London anymore, that they can continue to service them from continental European offices, that they have all the regulatory permissions in place. So what are the consequences? Well, the risks are that people get cut off from their clients, people get cut off from their service providers, cut off from their clearing houses. We have an enormous amount of disruption. When it comes to soft Brexit, it remains to be seen what the consequences are. What we're calling for within FIA, when we meet with regulators in the UK and in Europe, and when we meet with politicians and legislators, is there are three key outcomes you really need to try to achieve. The first one is to minimize disruption. That means you need to have transitional arrangements in place. I talked a moment ago about the two-year period of Article 50. It needs to be longer. We've suggested another 3 years to help ensure that people can transition their business models into this new regulatory paradigm. The second thing, after you minimize disruption, you need to avoid fragmentation. And that means let the market decide where to clear, in particular for euro-denominated derivatives, but in all classes of derivatives. And then finally, you need to maintain global access. Make sure people aren't cut off from clearing houses, from trade repositories, from trading venues, or indeed from their clients or service providers.
Well, let's talk about my favorite country to visit, Italy. You know, they seem to have some issues running government over there, right, Martin? I mean, this is just like, it's my favorite country to visit. I love it. It's beautiful. I've been all over it. But they seem to be that big risk that's been lingering for a while now, but markets yet to have a major response from Italy. It's like one of those things where you kind of have to dig deep to find out what's going on in Italy. You hear headlines and so on and so forth, but we're not getting the real market movements off of anything going on in Italy yet. Talk to us about what you are watching in Italy right now.
Well, I think the biggest concern I have in relation to Italy is the non-performing loans. I mean, the issue is very big, and it's been growing quite significantly in recent years. Although, if you look at Italy in terms of managing the budget, they've been doing the right thing. Yet, growth in Italy is anemic, and the banking situation has yet to be meaningfully addressed. If you look at non-performing loans on European banks' balance sheets, it's still 1 trillion euros. And out of these 1 trillion euros still sitting on European banks' balance sheets, you have 360 billion just for Italy. And just for one bank, which is Banco Monte dei Paschi, which is the oldest bank in the world, it still represents about 58 billion non-performing loans. So that's really, really big. And they've tried to set up a fund, Atalante 1, Atalante 2, to try to reduce these non-performing loans. They've tried to do structured vehicles so that they could sell part of these non-performing loans in a structured or the fashion way. But the problem has yet to be meaningfully addressed by the European central banks. And at some point, they're going to have to do something about it because the problem is very big.
Now, I want to talk a little bit more about these 210 yield curve that I watch very closely. And you and I have had this conversation before. It's something that I, over the years, have learned that if it gets flat, then that would be potentially bearish for the U.S. economy. We've talked about, you know, a lot of the things that's going on within the Fed, and we've talked about how the yield curve has reacted. It got down to 78 basis points, and you know, I read your blog all the time, and you said that 73 basis points is key support. So we hit 78, we've come off to up to 82 now. Talk to us about why that support level is important to you, and what do you think happens if it's broken? Like, what does it mean?
Okay. So, this is all part of the argument we had. And the 73, as you cite, 73.8, I've actually blogged about for probably about four or five years. And yep. It's been tested. And you and I know that when we watch charts, when something continually gets tested, it's only a matter of time before it gives way. So now we're down here again. This is the third time down here over the last 4 or 5 years. In 2016, it held almost to the tick that we had talked about. And I remember being out with you. We talked about 74.8. It was exactly where it held at. Now, if it goes through there, it's usually a signal that things are starting to slow down and people are leery about taking on risk, you know, of longer duration, and they start parking money into the treasury market. Is this time different? Well, I don't know. We do have, every time the Fed, you know, the major discussion right now is shrinking the balance sheet. Well, you know, there's two ways you can shrink the balance sheet. You can stop reinvesting things that reach their expiration, which is what the Fed is talking about, or you can actually become an active seller. The Fed can enter the market and start selling their assets that they've purchased in what Peter Buchvar has really nicely called a quantitative tightening, because when they were busy buying, we were calling it quantitative easing, and now we're on a QT, quantitative tightening. We don't know the impact that it's going to have, because really, if the Fed stops doing this, the curve ought to, and again, ought to, this is what should happen, the curve should steepen, because you're removing a buyer from the long end of the market, or, you know, a longer duration, regardless. And once the market really senses that the Fed, because nobody has stated a time, this is what they would like to do, and they're going to wait for whatever criteria they deem, because again, it's their ball game. They've taken this on by themselves. So the curve should steepen, because when people know that the biggest buyer in the market is going to be removed and may actually become a seller, they'll push bond prices down, yields higher, because hey, they're going to challenge them. That's what markets do. And that's what should be taking place here, but it's not. And it may be that the market is saying, hey, the Fed, you're raising rates and you're shrinking the balance sheet, which is reducing liquidity in the system and making the availability of liquidity more expensive. And we think you're doing this at the wrong time. And this is the great quandary that the markets exist in right now. And that all people who are investors have to monitor and go, this is the quandary. Is the Fed moving too late? Have they waited too long? And are we going into a, you know, cyclical, or, you know, there's economic cycles. We've been in a long-term growth cycle, not a robust one, but a continual growth cycle, one of the longest in history. So they're saying, well, you're starting to raise now, and you're starting to remove liquidity. You're too late to the party. And we think you're going to cause a recession. And if it breaks through that level, That's what the market is saying. Hey, you've waited too long, and we're looking for negative things, because the Fed believes fiercely that all their actions should lead to a steepening curve. I mean, they're out there talking, but we have to raise more because we have to push the long end of the curve higher, and that'll get people to think that the curve will go higher, because that's what their models say. But it's not happening. So I am watching this very carefully. I don't know, because of the Fed's breaking the market mechanisms, letting the market actually be the arbiter of value, it's very hard to determine. And that's what everybody is struggling with. But I, you know, that 210 curve for me has never failed. You know, a lot of people say, oh, the stock market's a bad indicator of recessions, because it's, you know, if you look at stock valuations at any time, as they famously like to quip, is that the stock market predicted, you know, 10 of the last 5 recessions because market actions. But that's not true about the 210 curve. The 210 curve, I would say, has 100% success. The problem is, from a trader standpoint, is how to time it. Because you can see the last time we had a massive flattening of the curve was 2007. We had an inversion. Well, the Fed was busy raising rates by a quarter of a basis point, which, who came up with a quarter of a basis point rate rise is ridiculous anyway, but that's my own thought. The long end was, as Bernanke said, because of the glove Asian savings, pushed the curve into an inversion, and we know what followed. It took 6 to 8 months, but it did come. So, you know, again, I've been watching these curves for a long, long time. I listen to people talk about them now who have no more knowledge of them than 5 years of knowledge, and I kind of laugh them when they're out there talking. This stuff is tried and true on yield curves. Is this time different? Well, we're going to find out because the only way it's going to be different is because, of course, the way the central banks have played with the markets and manipulated the markets. So we'll see. But I'm watching it again. I need weekly and, of course, monthly closes, which would be much more powerful signals than any day signal. So I just urge caution until we really get a more signal of a longer-term nature.
It's funny you said the market is your greatest teacher, and I'm someone who believes that although you should be going in and doing simulated trading, I believe that when you start trading live is really when you start to learn more about yourself. You're handling the emotions of it and all of that goes into it. And what I like about you guys is that you have this combine that doesn't teach technicals or fundamentals. Mm-hmm. It teaches risk management.
Yes, and that's how you get a feel for things. So I can show you guys this real quick if you guys want to jump into here. So basically, you talked about your trading account when you started. I started and I lost $330,000 trading accounts when I first started. So if you look at, we have, and I mentioned the simulated to funded kind of path that we have for any individual out there in the world. And we can start by just looking at a $30,000 account. What we do in the combine is we give you a simulated account with $30,000 starting balance. You have a maximum position size of a 3 lot. We're just looking at this one right here. And you can get different size accounts, but you have a daily loss limit of $500. Now, the users here need to understand, again, the feeling of trading. So simulated environment with max position size with a daily loss limit. And really, there's risk criteria that are built into this. And when I say built into this, you sign up, you get a $30,000 trading account, simulated account. You then come down here, and you have an objective. This objective allows you to understand, all right, how do I advance and progress at Top Step? And what this also does is it teaches people how to manage risk. These are the basic rules that we have. First, we need to see a trade at least 10 days. That gives us enough data to see how you're trading. Then also, we have here, do not hit or exceed your daily loss limit. Now, that's where the sweat hits the brow on that one, is when you're trading and you have a loss limit. Anybody can trade on a simulator without a loss limit. But this one allows you, and in the combine, allows you to feel what it's like to actually have some skin in the game. So now you're going to feel the markets. You mentioned that when you're live trading, you feel it. Well, this gives you a feeling of live trading when you have some criteria that you need to follow. And if you meet this objective, you advance towards a funded account.
So many traders put so much pressure on themselves to perform, and probably more than any other business, because obviously if you don't perform on a day in and day out basis, you're out of business. And I find that to be very similar to what athletes are. So when I saw that you were doing a talk speaking with athletes, I'm like, I've always compared what traders do to athletes, because I think that, you know, when the lights are on as a athlete, you have to perform. And for traders, the lights are on every day, because if you fail to perform, like I said, you're going to be out of business, and it can happen quickly. You know, same within pro sports. You can go down the tubes really quick. But if you sit there and you can focus and you could do what you know you could do, then you can have really great success. So my question is, do you see similarities between traders and pro athletes? And also talk about the differences. I don't want to just know about the similarities. I'd also like to know some of the differences that you see between us.
Yeah, a lot of similarities, and you've touched on a couple of them. It's all about your performance and what have you done for me lately. You have to be performing all the time, and the transparency of your performance. Obviously, there's a difference in transparency, and that, you know, most traders don't have, you know, thousands, sometimes millions of people watching and everybody criticizing you. It's obvious there's a lot of transparency in that your results are very obvious and you feel them. And both for pro athletes and trading, the results have direct financial implications. So I see a ton of parallel there. And you started off with, you know, how can you help people, because, you know, people putting so much pressure on themselves. And it really goes back to those four elements. When you start doing the four elements, then you realize, hey, my results matter. You know, ultimately, if you can't get trading results, or you can't get results on the field or the court, or on the baseball field, you're not going to be in that sport. And so those results matter, but putting the focus on the process as opposed to the results, and sort of detaching somewhat from the results. And this is very much what Phil Jackson, how he coached. It's very much how John Wooden coached, you know, the greatest really winners of all time in terms of championships in pro and college sports. So that helps a lot when you can do that. And the mindfulness and the meditation training helps that to happen. It's one thing to say, hey, I want to be in the present moment. I want to focus on the process. But if your automatic brain is not cooperating, you're going to have a hard time doing this. That's why you have to do the mental work. Otherwise, this is just theory that your brain will not let you practice. And the other thing I think that's huge, Anthony, is that, you know, I touched on emotions, and I hate to even bring it up because it's such a deep topic. But when people learn, and we have a little acronym we call C, which is to separate, embrace, evaluate. When you start changing your relationship with emotions from I'm trying to chase good ones and avoid bad ones to emotions are messages. They're messages trying to help me, trying to keep me productive and safe. So when I feel bad about bad performance or good about an apparent good performance, that's just a message. I want to hear, take the message in, let it pass, and then get back to an even keel into a mindful flow state outside of emotion. That's what we're looking to do with pro athletes and traders, or really any person. And that's what this C concept helps you do. If I feel, you know, disappointment or anger from a bad performance, a bad trade, instead of suppressing it or getting lost in it, I just separate. I got a chemical transmission, actually a neurotransmitter transmission in my brain. That's making me feel this way. It's trying to help me, so I want to embrace and totally feel that. And that allows it to pass through you, get the message, and then evaluate. You know, what at the end of the day, when things happen, no matter how you feel, it's what are you going to do? And for most of us, we don't have that clarity of thought because the emotion clouds that. That's why most of us can give great advice we can't keep ourselves, because we are so attached to the emotion and living the emotion. So that would be my recommendation for people that are in a high-pressure situation. And a lot of it, again, you got to take it from theory to training. You know, it's like you could say, here's how you get stronger physically, but that really doesn't matter if you don't do the work to get stronger physically, and the same is true mentally.
So just to clarify this, so what you're saying is that, because this is something you and I had talked about a little while ago, I was saying, you know, I don't watch the pound as much, and I watch the euro a lot. And I was saying, you know, I feel like the dollar right now is really getting weaker because of the strength in the euro. I felt the euro was probably going to be more of the driver to the dollar down. And you're saying that the pound strength versus the dollar, the pound is actually stronger technically, and therefore you think is driving more of the weakness in the dollar.
So actually, let's make this clear. I'm not paying as much attention as what is driving what. I'm paying attention of what is stronger than what.
Okay.
So the trigger, you're absolutely right, could have been the euro because the news was coming out of the euro. But the British pound looks like the winner across the three currencies.
Gotcha. No, that makes sense. So you think that the one that's leading the upside action is the pound. The pound is the stronger one.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. The pound is definitely stronger because the euro pound is actually going down.
Understood.
When if you look at the British pound versus other currency pairs, the British pound is going up. Right? So euro pound going down, that means euro is, so euro, that's why I kind of, as a metaphor, I refer to currency pairs as a dancing pair, right? So right now, the euro pound going down means that the pound is stronger, pushing the currency that is quoted the second is basically its strength is the opposite of the direction of the currency pair, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does. So talk to me about what opportunities this is presenting you with any possible trades.
All right. So that is where it gets exciting. So euro dollar, let's talk about that because I know a lot of people might have positions in euro dollar because it's one of the major currencies that everybody trades. So euro dollar still does have potential to get back up to 115. The reason why I say that is because since the downfalls of 2015 that got the euro down to the lows of 104, 105 level, the pair has been ranging between 105-ish, that zone, to 115. So now sometimes in the past 2 years, it has gone a little bit, it's tested a little bit above it, it has tested a little bit below 105, it has tested a little bit above 115, but it has been just going back and forth between these two levels. And that is the reason why, especially with the volatility and the massive push in the euro dollar, even if we see some backward movements today, some pullbacks, there is a chance that in the coming weeks, we could see another push and try for the pair to reach 1.15 or even 1.16 before heading back down. So now, this is just a range trade position, and I don't have any other long-term technical signals to back this up. I only have one. I normally want to have three, but I only want to have one for this one. So I'm not going to take a position on this. I'm just saying there is a potential. There's a chance for this. But the one I have more signals on to back this up is actually the British pound versus the Japanese yen. So previously, we were seeing a signal of British pound versus the Japanese yen actually going back down to 136. But today we are seeing actually three signals of British pound having the potential of reaching 147.13. So we could see this again medium to long term. Tomorrow we could see a little bit of a pullback, which is my ideal time of entering a buy position. I normally wait. When I see the signals, I wait, I take a breath. And the next day, when the market's going to pull back and correct, I get into a buy position. And that could be an interesting, more highly likely, lower risk or medium risk trade to target 147.13 for a medium to short-term trade on the daily chart.
Now, you mentioned to me that traders should ask other traders a lot of questions. I think that this world needs to ask their peers a lot more questions. I mean, when you work with people in an industry, I think it's extremely important to always pick their brains. I know I'm always doing it. I asked a lot of questions at the beginning of my career, and I think that that really did help me out. We talked about one of them just a little bit ago when I asked, you know, the traders, what was this something that I really need to know before I begin to trade? And they're like, no, you're wrong before you're right. And I would have never learned that if I didn't ask that question. So, you know, I feel like you can never learn enough in this business. And if you have an open mind, you can allow yourself to take the knowledge and even the mistakes that other traders make and put them into your trading, right? Into your trading plan. So what questions do you think new and even advanced traders should ask their peers?
Well, when I started out in the business, you know, talking to the younger guys that were just a few years in, they were full of confidence and you know, thought they knew what they were doing. And, you know, they were back and forth. They were winners one day, losers the next, always thinking they knew what was going to happen in the market. You talk to somebody that has been in the business for 30 years, and they would first thing they'd say, I'm still learning. Don't try to, you know, think I know what the market's going to do. I try to look for the trend and get my, you know, get my trade in that, you know, if I think the market's heading higher, don't try to get the high and low. You look for that 60% in the middle. And, you know, they're always flexible. They look at a chart. They look at the fundamentals. They try to balance the two. Well, new traders say, hey, this is the bottom of the market. I think it's here. I'm going to, you know, double down everything. New traders should definitely talk to experienced traders and get the idea that, you know, they're learning every day. There's going to be something new, especially in nowadays with the global market, you know, compared to what it was 20 years ago. You also have a lot of extra money being thrown. Hedge money, professional traders are coming to this market. You got the algo trading. So there's a lot different things happening now than there was, you know, 20, 25 years ago.
Thank you for listening to Futures Radio Show. If you have any questions or comments for myself or my guests, please visit futuresradioshow.com and sign up to be a premium member for free. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes.